Well, it's a real pleasure to be here today, and it is a pleasure to follow Steve. Steve is a very good economist. Pay attention to what he said. Now, for the other side of the story, you're going to listen to me. Well, it is interesting because, you know, I am with the credit side of the bank, and Wells Fargo credit policy or motto is, we're not happy till you're not happy, okay? And as credit officers, we try to live up to that policy every day. You know, and it is interesting because, you know, economists do have a well-deserved reputation for being kind of, you know-it-alls. I'm originally from Western Minnesota, and a few weeks back, I was out in Western Minnesota, and I was presenting in a Quonset hut, you know, to seed guys. And it was interesting. There was an older lady in the front row, and she just got more and more agitated as I spoke. And she finally couldn't stop herself. She says, aren't you a know-it-all son of a bitch? I said, hey, come on, Mom. Okay, so why am I telling that joke? It's because, you know, we're up here today, and we're going to talk about a lot of things. You know, Steve did a great job. Think about the quantity of information that Steve talked about. I'm going to go over some of the same ground. Talk about the same facts, different interpretations, and we're not even going to scratch the surface of the elements that go into making up this world. We are just hitting the highlights. And that's amazing because your head's already spinning with all the facts that you've been presented. You're going to get some more here. So the point that I'm trying to make is my favorite two answers are I don't know and I was wrong, okay? And yet Wells Fargo pays me a damn good salary. Because this is not foreseeable. I mean, we will forecast and we will be wrong. Now, that doesn't make it a bad forecast. It's because what we have to deal with is absolutely so complex. I'm going to start out with this slide. This is a slide I usually start out with most of my presentations. This is kind of an indication against what we typically do in a lot of economics. An economic, who's had the pleasure of taking an economics course in their life? At 8 o'clock in the morning, taught by somebody, right? Lots of math when you didn't want to do it. But one of the problems we have is economics has what I call physics envy. We want to be as prestigious and as precise as physicists. But we put these equations up on the board and we say, solve the equation. Then we use algebra, we use calculus, we use all sorts of fancy mathematics. How many people have found that you can really solve the world? You can't solve the world. I think what we need to remember is that we live in a system. And the problem with the system is you have feedback loops. Now, philosophically, this seems like a kind of a really philosophical point, really mundane. But think about this. In a system with at least one or more feedback loops, it becomes inherently chaotic, inherently unpredictable. Okay. So we're going to talk about land values today. And land values depend upon so many other linkages back into the agricultural system. You heard Steve talk about some of them, you know, interest rates, crop prices, policies. Just think about three feedback loops that we have into the ag situation. Valuing ag assets and saying, what are they worth? If you start with the philosophy that we are working with a system with feedback loops in it, with external shocks that are beyond our ability to foresee, you have to step back and say, I will not forecast the future. I'm going to live it. Something's going to happen, but it's inherently unforecastable. So the question is not what is my forecast, but what is my strategy for dealing with the current environment we find ourselves in and the most likely scenarios? Because here's what I push farmers. Farmers don't like to hear what I have to say. What would farmers like for most economists or market analysts to do? Stand up there, give them a number. They know my number's going to be wrong, and they don't care about that. Because then it becomes my mistake. So when they didn't sell their corn at the right time, or when they didn't do the right activity, who's to blame? I'm to blame, right? I gave them the wrong number. But here's the problem. They are now have to do more strategic analysis and step back out of this idea of blaming the forecaster, and they have to say, look, I'm a business manager, and what am I going to do about the risk in my world? Let's start out with this chart. This is a very straightforward, very simple financial calculation. Who in this room is familiar with net present value? You probably all are, right? Net present value is a calculation of what is the future flow of income or future cash flow of an asset worth today. Now, this is the current net present value, the historical net present value of ranching and farming income in this country over the last 40 years. Somebody see a problem with this chart? You do not get exponential growth in the world's oldest industry. So suddenly, we're saying that you go back 8-10 years ago, the net present value of ranch and farm income in this country under this calculation was $1 trillion. So if we sold American agriculture to somebody and they were using this calculation, they would have paid us $1 trillion to buy this farm income, these assets from us. Today, it's $3 trillion. Really? You tell me that's right? Either the historical number was all wet or the current number is all wrong. They can't both be right. You don't see exponential growth in an old line growth industry like agriculture. Now, farmers think that I'm being mean to agriculture. No. I want them to step back and be financial analysts. Don't fall in love with a stock. I mean, certain people fall in love with certain stocks. I know people who own Apple stock today who are in love with it. They can't see anything wrong with Apple. But we got to think about our investments in agriculture just as tough-minded as if we think about every other investment that we have in our portfolio. So this market's on fire, and the question is why, and is it correct? Let's go back and talk about net present value. Typically, when you buy an asset, you're going to trade a pile of cash for that future income that you're buying associated with that asset. Now, you could say there's some residual value in the future, or you're just looking at future income flows. There's all sorts of nuance of mix in this. But the two fundamental drivers of net present value when you buy an asset, whether you're buying farm ground, a livestock operation, an ethanol mill, is what's my future income, cash flow, and what's my alternative opportunity cost to make this investment? Those are the two fundamental drivers. So when we think about this, people are excited about owning ag assets. We know that. We hear about a lot of young people wanting to come back to agriculture. Why? Because incomes are up, asset values are up, and everybody wants to play in a winning field. Now, think about that sudden explosion in net present value. This is what's driving it. This is from the USDA database. This is a 5-year rolling average of net farm and ranch income. And what's the alternative cost value? I'm taking 10-year treasuries plus 100 basis points. Well, I think we want to really understand how these two things are working together. Because yes, farm income has gone way up. And this is exciting. When you have more cash flow, life looks better. I guarantee you that, because I've been in that situation. When you're a grad student, you get your first job, heck yes, that looks nice, right? You have a lot more income. So we've taken that farm income down around $50 billion, early 2000s, and we're driving close to $100 billion. There's a lot more income in the hands of ranching and farming today. A lot more, a part of it is in the farm side than the ranch side. But what else has happened that we're taking for granted? We have an incredibly low alternative financing environment. We had, earlier this year, 10-year treasury selling at 1.4%. That meant that the market, in its infinite wisdom, perfect market, right, was willing to give the U.S. government money for 10 years for a measly 1.4% return. Who in this room thinks that's a real good deal? Who wants to put their name on that deal? You just heard Steve talk about the financial cliff and all the issues that we have. Predictability is just not there. When you think about this, farm income has been a big driver of the increase in the value of farm and ranch assets. But a bigger piece, twice as much of the valuation in the current model, is coming from the ultra-low financing environment we find ourselves in. And the question is it sustainable? And the answer is obviously no. So the question is, what happens when it reverses itself? Does income stay strong? Probably. But what happens when the alternative cost of money goes up dramatically at some point in the next 3 to 5 to 6 years? What's that going to do to the net present value of farm ranch income valuations? It's going to have a negative impact. We know that. So we know that, but what are we going to do about it? I keep telling people it's so much more important to have discipline than intelligence when it comes to investing. Because so much of us, We know these things are wrong, but can we bring ourselves not to operate on these things? So let's jump ahead here. I'm going to kind of see the same facts as Steve, but I'm going to spin them my way, which is typical of economists. I think that the drivers for what we're seeing today are pretty straightforward. Steve did a great job. I agree with him on that. We see good income globally. We see good population growth. But I think the policy piece is so much more important in terms of the shockability of the system and the volatility than the fundamental drivers. And I think that we need to keep an eye on both the fiscal and the monetary policy because we underestimate the amount of leverage that they put into the system. Now, this is not unique to agriculture. Wells Fargo was one of the largest banks in the world. We lend to every possible sector of the economy. We are seeing private equity groups come out of the woodworks trying to buy every asset that they can, not just agricultural, but every asset. Why? Because they can borrow money at obscenely low rates for very long durations and then push them into whatever business they want to buy and try to get the multiple to grow. They're taking enormous amounts of leverage, enormous amounts of risk, pushing up the multiples in every single sector of this economy. This is not unique to agriculture. This is not about agriculture when we talk about the monetary, the fiscal policy. We're going to be collateral damage when these things change, and they will change. So what I want to talk about today is not a forecast, because I don't know when, and I don't know how much these things are going to change. But I do know that when you look at the trends that we've had, it is much more likely for a scenario that there's going to be a negative impact on the monetary and fiscal side. And what should we assume will happen for valuations of assets? That's what I want to talk about. Now, Steve talked about this, and here's a chart that I think helps illustrate what he was talking about. Here's 100 years worth of price data for corn. Now, you don't recognize the numbers on the left-hand side. Why? Because I took a logarithm of the national cash price of corn since 1912 to this year. Why a logarithm? Well, if you remember back to your high school days, you take a logarithm of something when it has exponential growth in it, and it changes it back to be linear. So you can talk about the change in a linear number instead of looking at exponential numbers. It doesn't make it very easy to compare prices in 1912 to $8 plus corn in 2012. But what I want you to think about on this chart is not the numbers, but the pattern. What do you see on this chart? You see stair steps. You see that we had a price from 1912 to just before World War II. World War II was a shock, drove up prices to a new and higher level, stayed there with quite a bit of volatility around there. In 72, oil embargo, Soviet grain buying shock came into the system, knocked us up to a new level. We stayed there until 2007. Now we're looking for a new level. What you don't see on this chart is a long-term linear trend starting in the bottom left-hand corner and working its way on a very progressive basis to the upper right-hand corner. You don't see a long-term trend. You see a very defined stair-step function in prices. Prices stay in a range, and then something, whatever it is, World War II, oil embargo shock, policy shock, says, hey, you're wrong. You have the wrong price for this commodity. Knock it up and push it to a new level. And that's what it does. Now, what we're really trying to figure out in today's world is what's the new level? You go back a year ago, and if you talk to a lot of ag economists, Rabobank had a number out, we have a number out, and he said, what's the new long-term price of corn? And what would people have said? Oh, $4.50, $5, something in that range. Well, after a year of having higher prices again, and expectation of having high prices in 2013, people have a tendency to drag their numbers up. Why? Because you hate to be the idiot that's that far away from the current price, right? Quite seriously, if you give them what you really think, you sound like a real fool. And people hate to be foolish. I'm willing to be foolish, okay? That's my benefit here today. I'm willing to tell you that I think that long-term prices of corn are not going to be $5.50 or $6. I think they're probably going to be closer to $4.50. It was a good number a year ago. It's a good number today. We're going to talk about what that means and why. Now, could I be wrong? Oh, yes, I could be wrong. Should you invest on my analysis? Oh, no, you should not invest on my analysis. Okay, I don't know and I'll be wrong. But think about that. If you don't at least entertain the idea of a different price set for corn, you're never going to get enough doubt in your minds to to really do good analysis. So stair steps, not a long-term trend. Now, I'm not going to doubt or dispute in any way that income and population are primary drivers of demand for agriculture. But you go back and you look at this last chart and you say, if they're long-term trends, why don't we see the same long-term trend in price? Well, clearly there's more at work. There's also the feedback loop of supply. So let's take a look here. Here's global GDP. Let's stipulate clearly that global GDP is a very crappy number, okay? Now, that's a technical term. But I want you to think about this. Think about what we're trying to do with a number like GDP. We're trying to take every single economic transaction in the world and drive it back into a single number, adjusted for inflation, adjusted for currencies, and make it comparable from year to year. How likely is it that we did a good job generating global GDPs? Terrible. What's the only hope that we can have when we talk about global GDP? That we're consistently wrong in how we generate this number, so that we can do a comparison from year to year. This is one of the things that always makes me just shake my head in amazement. We think we have good numbers. The numbers are horribly wrong. The only thing we can hope as analysts is that they're consistently wrong. Our temperature gauge doesn't know what it's measuring. As long as it's a consistent temperature gauge, it might be useful. Taking that stipulation into mind, what do we think we see for global GDP? A consistent long-term trend upwards. Here's a surprising fact. If you go look at these numbers, these are USDA numbers for global GDP, real GDP, adjusted for inflation. The 60s and the 70s had a higher growth rate than the 2000s. That's something that surprises people. We had a higher growth rate in global GDP back in the 60s and the 70s than we do today, even with the monster submersion of China. If you think about this, go back to World War II and think about global GDP since the end of World War II. The 50s and the early 60s were dominated by the recovery of Europe from the devastation of World War II. Then the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s were the emergence of Japan and Korea. And then we shifted in the 90s to the 2000s to the Indias and the Chinas of the world. There's always been somebody there growing and growing phenomenally well. Not the same people. They passed the baton over time. But it's not like we just suddenly discovered world GDP growth. In fact, we're growing at a slower rate today than we were back in the 60s and the 70s. So, trend on global GDP is slowing. Now, back to a point that Steve made that's clearly fundamental, is once you achieve a certain level, it has an impact. So, $2,000 a person versus $8,000 is a big difference when it comes to demand for food, fiber, and energy. So clearly, growth rates in and of themselves are not everything here. What about world population? Here's an area, and I'm going to be very, very clear, where I am fundamentally different than most ag economists and most commodity advisors. I think that global population growth rates, and you can see this even on a linear trend basis, you can see that the slope is slowing over time. Back in the 60s, 70s, there was about 2% global population growth rate annually. We're down to 1%. We've fallen in half in the last 30 to 40 years. So still, a big growth rate number, 1%, is nothing to sneeze at. And on a higher base, more bodies coming in. But we've seen a remarkable slowdown in growth rates in developing countries. If you put your hands into the data, I always say farmers treat the facts just like they treat the busboy at Hooters. They never look at him either, right? But if you... My wife approved that joke, by the way. But if you stick your hands into the global population database and start pulling out numbers, which is really a stupid thing to do, but I have time to do it. But if you do that, you'll find out something remarkable. Steve's number shows that sub-Saharan Africa growth, the biggest single piece, they have Nigeria, of all countries, going from 150 million people to 1 billion people. In their long-term forecasts. Nigeria, Africa, is going to have 1 billion people in 2100. That's 90 years out, so it's a long ways out. But if Nigeria were to ever hit that number that they have in their forecast in that database, they would have 8.5 times the population density of China. Now, you tell me that number is really going to happen. The reason why I'm being so strong in this is I think these numbers are fundamentally flawed. And I'm even more cynical than you can imagine. I believe that the UN and the FAO, Food Agricultural Organization, is a fundamentally European-centric organization. And they are fundamentally environmentalists. It means they don't like people. Seriously. We do a lot of business in Europe. We do a lot of business in California. They don't like people. They have a fundamental aversion to them. Now, I'm being very clear here. You're seeing my bias. I'm not trying to hide my bias. I don't trust them. And I believe that they have a very strong growth rate in some of these numbers when they know they should be slowing down their forecasting. Why? Because if they don't have a huge growth rate in population, how can they scare policymakers around the world into doing more restrictive policies? There is a very cynical view of the numbers that we're getting into the system. But if we aren't smart enough to know that people have biases, whether they're bankers or whether they're policymakers at the FAO, we're really missing the boat. These numbers don't have an immaculate conception. They don't come out of the air. They don't come out of spreadsheets without a whole lot of thought process going into them. So here's the point. Population is not going to grow as fast as we've projected. Personally, I think even their low-end forecasts are a little bit overestimating. Look at the United States. We are the third largest country in the world. People forget that. We have 315 million people. Only China and India are bigger countries than we are. We have the highest population growth rate in the world for a well-developed country. We have over 1.1%. Last 3 years, we've seen a remarkable downshift in U.S. population growth. Why? People are putting off having children because of the economic situation, and immigration has fallen. We're seeing a remarkable response down. We're the largest, fastest-growing developed country in the world. But you look at countries like Brazil, you look at countries like Mexico, and their population growth rates are literally collapsing, not going to negative, but collapsing. They're no longer 3.5%. They're at our rate or even lower, some of these developing countries. But yet, when you look at the United Nations forward forecast on population, which is a big part of what is agricultural assets worth, they remain extremely high growth rates in countries like Somalia, Nigeria, Bangladesh. Countries that we know, as they see more economic growth, will see dramatic declines in their population growth rates. I can't be any clearer than that. I am incredibly dubious, doubtful, skeptical of some of these growth rates for population. I think there's more to the story in terms of agendas than simply fair forecasts. So take that for what it's worth, but don't forget that there's a lot of issues behind the scenes. Now, policy can be a shock. You know, trends are very clear, but policy can be a shock. You know, Steve did a great job looking at these numbers, so I won't dwell on them. But clearly, when you can take ethanol from 500 million bushels of corn to 5 billion, that is not something you see driven by biological use. Biological use does not see that type of growth rate in today's world. Biological growth is driven by what we just talked about, population and income and diet. And those are strong fundamental factors, but not things that change by 10, 20, 30% per year. Those are things that change by 4, 5, 6% per year. So here, the shock came from the ethanol. Now, if we'd all been smart, we would have gone back in 2005 and bought a lot of farm ground. Well, I didn't. I didn't see this happening. Clearly, it's a consequence, but I didn't forecast it very well. Here's the other issue that we have, love it or hate it. I got in a little trouble last week. I was in California. I was making fun of a minority in California. That's not a good thing to do, right? You know who the minority was? It was an ethanol supporter. So, get it? And now I bring up that for a point for a reason. Here in this room, most of the people in this room like ethanol. Why? Because ethanol has been beneficial to the people we work with, beneficial for the asset values that they own. You go around this country, and I guarantee you, it's not universally loved. Universally loved? No. It has a lot of anti-ethanol people out there, and we need to know that they also have a dog in the fight. What we've done is we've connected energy and agriculture in a new way. And the volatility that we have with weather is now compounded by the volatility we have in energy prices. Steve made a point earlier. You could see we were at $140 a barrel for crude oil. Somehow, we thought that was right. For a moment, we thought crude oil really should be worth $140 a barrel. Then, within less than a year, it had fallen to about $40, $60 a barrel. Both those numbers, at the point in time that they occurred, were the right numbers. So what does that tell us? We're crazy, right? And when we look at this number going forward, are we crazy enough to put in our forecast? Think about that. You ask people, like, where is the long-term price of crude oil going to go? And they can give you an incredibly good, nuanced answer. You know what? They don't know. I don't know. It could be as high as 140 again. It could be as low as 30 again over the next 2 to 3 years. So what's the flow-through implications into agriculture? They're there. Think about that. Another question. What's going to happen if the renewable fuel standards gets a waiver? What happens if we change the policy? Good questions. Once again, do we really know? I hear people all the time talk about this question. These ethanol plants already exist. So when an ethanol plant exists, what does it worry about? Capital recovery? No, it worries about marginal cost. Think about just last year. Last year, we saw an ethanol plant in Pennsylvania, which we would call a destination market because they're not in corn surplus. It was sold for 10 cents per gallon of capacity. We saw plants in Iowa and Nebraska that were in a corn surplus area that are considered source plants getting sold in the $80 to $1.20 range. Same asset class, literally the same technology being sold for a huge differential based on location economics. But the point is, you're not going to build a new ethanol plant in this environment, but you can certainly buy them. 10 cents on the dollar for gallon capacity in certain markets, you know, dollar plus in other markets, if you can even get them. So ethanol plants already exist. They're going to be in this mix for quite a while until they wear out and we don't need them or they get built again. What do blenders care about? Blenders do not care about anything about the price of corn. Blenders care about making money blending ethanol. Drove down to Sioux Falls, South Dakota on Tuesday, going through Butterfield, Minnesota. Anybody know where Butterfield, Minnesota is? Okay. I looked at the local gasoline, $3.35 for unleaded gasoline. What was E85 selling for that day? $3.34. A penny discount for E85. Now, does that make any sense to a motorist? If you're buying gasoline strictly based upon performance of mileage delivered per dollar, does that make any sense? No, absolutely not. So why in the world are they able to sell $3.34 E85 in Butterfield, Minnesota? Because the local farmers love E85, right? But here's my point. The blenders don't care about the price of corn. The blenders don't care about the price of anything. They care about moving gasoline and ethanol and making as much money as they possibly can. They will blend as much ethanol as they're allowed to blend if it makes them money. And they will blend as little ethanol as possible if it doesn't make them money. At the end of the day, what drives the ethanol market is demand for transportation. And it's not an easy equation. What does cheap corn do? I hear dairy farmers, I tell you, we're the largest agricultural financer in the country, and we have a lot of dairy financing in California. It's a very grim situation right now in California. We've seen more dairy bankruptcies in California this year than the previous 20 years put together. That's a tough situation. What's their hope? They're hoping that they get a huge exemption from ethanol in come November. They think that would drive down the price of corn. But what does cheap corn do for ethanol producers? Allows them to blend more, make more ethanol, right? So here's the problem that we have. People think that cheap corn is something going to help them. Well, cheap corn might just push up more and more ethanol usage. So we don't know. These are so many variables that we're not really good at figuring out because it's not a great straightforward system. When do ethanol plants make money? Boy, you get this question all the time. Are they making money? Who knows? I mean, you got so many variables floating around out there. Take a very basic number. All other per bushel, about $1.20. When you put in the enzymes, surfactants, you put in the labor, plant maintenance, you know, basic cash costs, about $1.20. When you look at that today, when you look at the spread between corn prices and ethanol prices, they really shouldn't be running at all. But why are they running? Because you're paying 108% on a dry matter basis for distiller's grain versus corn. Figure that one out. There was a question earlier about what about distiller's grain? Why in the world, as a feeder, am I going to pay 108% on a dry matter basis versus corn? Because I'm trying to replace the proteins? Why not just buy the proteins in the corn? Well, I might have some limits on feeding this or that. But typically, we see distiller's grain discounted at 20% on a dry matter basis to corn. Now it's at an 8% premium. There's no constant in this market. People say, when do you make money in ethanol? And the answer is, who knows? Depends on whether they're going to pay this or that. We just don't know. We do know that the market cares a lot about it. Take a look here. This is the weekly spot ethanol price out of Iowa versus the weekly corn price out of Iowa since 2010. Pretty good R squared. On a bivariate basis, this is a scatter diagram, 0.84 R squared. That means that one versus the other, they explain 84% of the volatility. That's a really strong relationship. That means only 16% of what happens week to week between ethanol and corn is explained by something else or by just pure noise. That's an incredibly strong relationship. And going back to a point that you heard earlier, one of the things that's unusual is look what's happened in this environment. We've been increasing our ethanol production even as we've driven down gasoline demand. This is a 52-week rolling basis for gasoline distribution in the United States. Back to a point you heard earlier, they never would have forecasted. And cut them some slack, because for the better part of three decades, we had never seen a sustained decline in gasoline demand in this country. 2007 was the first time we saw a turn in the system, and we haven't seen a five-year-plus decline in gasoline ever since we started driving cars in this country. It just doesn't happen. I mean, we don't have statistics back in the Great Depression, but you go back to as far back as we have into the 60s, we don't have any period of time where we had this type of departure from the long-term trend. We heard why. Economics. Gasoline is expensive, jobs are scarce, and people just aren't driving their cars. And it's only going to get worse, as we heard, because as cars get more efficient and as we put more mass transit into play, gasoline demand is simply not going to be as robust as forecast. This huge gap is going to have to be addressed via policy. Now, I'll give the ethanol industry a lot of credit. They are much more disciplined in terms of making on and off decisions than a lot of other industries. You can see here back in the end of 2011, they were getting a huge price signal to produce as much ethanol as possible. The spread between corn and ethanol was incredibly favorable at the end of 2011. We peaked out close to almost 1 million barrels of ethanol production per day. Every plant that could run was running. They had every incentive to run as hard and fast as they can. Right now, we're down to 800,000 barrels per day. What's happened? You heard, less gasoline export. Basically, we had taken this difference, built up stocks, and also exported a lot of ethanol. That's not happening today. We're not building up ethanol stocks, and we're not exporting at the same rate that we did before. But as we go forward, as we have this collision between demand and production, where is this going to go? I have no idea. Neither do farmers, neither do most forecasters. We can talk about a lot of scenarios, but the possibilities are huge. Just in the last 6 months or year or so, we've seen a 200,000 barrel per day swing in ethanol production. That's an incredibly huge variation in corn demand. So you have this much volatility in this short period of time, and you're feeling confident about, you know, where these prices are going? That's a tough one. International supply response. Talk about upward trending things. Here is global grain production according to the USDA's international database. And you can see that back in the 60s and the early 70s, we had a much steeper curve on grain production growth. Then in the 80s, slows down. It doesn't stop, but slows down. Want to go back and make a fundamental observation. Prices matter. One of the reasons why the slope of grain production slowed down was there was no price incentive to do it faster. When you had $2.25 corn in the United States and you had it working its rations out around the world crop markets, there was not a huge incentive for people to chase production. Now, the last couple of years, we've seen a really strong price signal. What I believe is that you have to be very careful about going backwards and looking at growth rates without taking context of pricing information. So does this mean we're condemned to a slower growth rate and that's going to make it tough? I don't think so. I think that we really have to wait 5 or 10 years, which is an eternity for most forecasting models, to see what kind of response rate we get from this global supply. So where are we at? I call us the Saudi Arabia of corn, which is a great place to be. Think about this. This is some of the same data you might have seen, but presented a little bit different. This is grain production. And you can see grain and cereals, and you can see the United States is just behind China in terms of total production. But when you take another factor into consideration, population, you can see there's a different story. Because to be an important part of the global grain markets, you both have to have a high surplus per person and a great amount of corn or cereals to sell. That makes you important. We have the most throw weight, so to speak, in the whole system because we have the greatest amount of production just behind China, and we have a huge per capita production, which means we have a lot of exportable, or we can sluice it into fuel use if we want. This makes us the key driver around the world. But we're not alone. Take a look here. This is real wealth. This is something that we should be proud of in agriculture. Back in the early 60s, we produced about 1,500 pounds of grain per person in the United States. Right now, closer to 2,500. That's real wealth. That means even with the growth rates that we've had in this country for population, production has gone up even faster. We have more grain per person to put into more options, whether it's feeding, fuel, or exports, than we did before. That really means you have a lot to offer the world. But look at the bottom here, Brazil. Now, Brazil gets swamped in the early years by our level of grain production. And you can see over the last couple of years, they've had some volatility, but they've been growing. In fact, their growth rate has been substantially better than our growth rate. Now, there's still a world behind us when it comes to per capita grain supply. But as they grow, they have more options. And I think what I want to make the point here is relative competitiveness. We take it for granted that we're going to set the price in so many markets. But as other people grow their supply on a per capita basis, they either exclude imports or they grow their ability to export. And cumulatively, that has a big impact. 85% of the grain ground in this world is outside of the United States. 85% of the grain production in this world is outside the United States, and typically is half the yield that we have. Why? It's not because they're lazy. It's not because they're stupid. It's because they haven't had the price signal and the opportunity to do better. Now they're getting the price signal to do more with what they have. So think about that. If that other 85% even improves at a marginally better rate, it has a huge impact due to the weighting of the amount of ground outside the United States. Where are we taking this point? We're saying, okay, what is U.S. agricultural ground worth? Why? Because if we ignore the linkages from all these different subsystems that come into agriculture, we're missing a very important signal for competition. So what's the farmer doing about it? Let's talk about that. Let's go through his flow chart here. Want to expand? Yes. Stupid question. Is land overpriced? Yes. Buy more? No. Buy more. Could we reduce this flow chart to a single box here? I think we could. Yes. Farmers want to buy more land, and we know why. Because it's been a winner, and farmers know that over multiple generations, farm ground is a great asset. I'm not knocking it. I wish I had more of it. You know, I used to say, what's the new joke in Iowa? It's, what does it take to be a millionaire? And the answer is 80 acres, right? But we were talking about that farm deal yesterday for $21,900, right? I'm going to have to redo my joke. 40 acres. But think about that. You know, farmers love land. We look and we think about the net present value and why land is going up. It's because people really believe in the value of the ground. And the answer is yes, valuable asset. The question is it a good asset at today's prices? That's a very different question. Nobody is knocking the fact that agricultural ground is a great asset. And it has a great track record. But the question is it a great price today? Or should we be pushing farmers to think about it differently? So let's talk about that. I went back and looked at Minnesota Farm Management Database. And I went back and I looked at the cash rent component. Why? Because I wanted to say, okay, if cash rent represents the market, and it does in a very flawed way, we know that when you look at cash rents, it's a huge mixture of at-market rents that are being set through, you know, auctions, and what I would call little old lady rates, people that have been doing 30 years of renting and have historical prices that have no connection to the current market whatsoever. But between those two, you have the cost of renting ground. I went back and looked at the last 18 years, and I said, how much of the yield ends up in the landlord's pocket? Because as a farmer, whether I rent it or whether I own it, I'm my own landlord. Okay? So 25% of the yield ends up going to land. And it ranges. It's been as high as 40%. It's been low as, you know, under 16%. It varies based on different factors, different times. But over time, 25% of the yield that comes off that ground is going to go back to the land. Who in this room remembers the Cobb-Douglas production function? Steve, raise your hand. You know, capital labor, right? We talk about returns to inputs, right? Historically, when you look at the Cobb-Douglas function, which is a production function in this country, what's the historical break between capital and labor? 70-30. 70% goes to labor, 30% goes to capital. Now, there's a very rough number, but you think about that. Capital gets paid for being capital, and labor gets paid for being labor. Land, which is the primary part of capital in farming, gets 25% of the yield. So this is not some kind of wildly out of proportion number. I'm not coming up here saying it gets 50%. I'm not coming up here and saying it gets 5%. 25%. Here's the other point that we need to point out to farmers. Management, if we look at these categories, net margins with government payments, which used to be a lot more important, and management and own labor, that's 20%. So under the same calculation, 20% of the yield over the last 18 years has gone to pay for these categories. So labor is almost, management is almost as important as the land itself. So what does that mean to farmers? They all want to own the ground. We know that. They want to own the acres because that's real wealth. But they get almost as much benefit from simply managing the acres as they do from owning the acres. Now, what do farmers like to do? They like to play the schizophrenia game, right? They like to value their assets when they need to at market rate, and when they don't want to, they want to do it at a historical basis, right? Because if you ask them, what's your return on asset, they'll give you the historical basis, right? When they ask you how much they can borrow for, they want to give you the current market rate, right? Well, that's fine. That's how people work. But when you think about that, the real returns, the breakout of where these corn bushels are going to go, 25% goes for owning the land, 20% goes for managing the ground. Where does the other 55% go? It goes to DuPont for the good seed they're providing. It goes to BSFF for the good chemical they're providing. It goes to John Deere for the good equipment they're providing. It goes to diesel. It goes to crop insurance. It goes to all those other inputs. But 45% ends up in labor and management's hands, and another 25% ends up for paying for land. Now, I want to point out, when you look at farmers, and we all know this, in every single industry, there's a huge spread between top performers and bottom performers. The last couple of years have been unique. Even the poorest of managers in this environment are making good money because they're just benefiting from the high prices. But the key driver of being successful in agriculture is being the best manager of agronomics. Heard a lot about that today. It is the key. But here's the thing that you forget. Even though the worst performers in agriculture today are making decent money, the top performers are making even more money. So the guys who were struggling in 2005 and 2004 with LDPs, they were barely making the rent checks, they're pretty happy today. But you know what? They're even worse off today than they were back then. Why? Because the guys that were better managers are making even more money, and they're going to take all that excess funds that they're generating and come right back after the poor operators and drive them right out of business. So there is no escaping the fact that you have this differential. Now, this sounds like a really bearish attitude. Remember, I'm their banker, okay? I get to see them naked. They actually bring my P&Ls to me, okay? Some of them don't make much money even in good times. What's the other driver here? Knowledge has economies of scale. Equipment doesn't have economies of scale. Land does not have economies of scale. Chemical does not have economies of scale. Knowledge does. So those farmers that are better at accumulating knowledge and managing knowledge and agronomic information, they can put it out over more and more acres, and they don't wear themselves out. Their knowledge is not dissipated by going over more acres. It has increasing returns. So the knowledge and the technological change is the biggest driver here. Now, we're going to talk about land deals. I'm not going to talk and dig into each individual land market. We all know that they're hot. But here's the thing I want to point out. The easy deals are always overpriced, whether you're talking about garbage pickup, beer distribution, or farm ground. Now, why would I mention the first two? Because I was sitting out in California last week with one of our special credit officers. He's in charge of looking at deals. And everybody loves to do garbage pickup financing. Why? Because it's incredibly profitable. People generate garbage. They got to pay that monthly bill. You pick it up. You make a lot of money in garbage pickup. But what do you see in the industry when it comes to financing? Everybody leverages up the deals to the ultimate last potential earnings. Any hiccup in garbage pickup, bang, the deal falls apart. So his concern was not about the profitability. He says all these guys are incredibly profitable. Problem is they've piled so much debt on top of their profitability that if there's a single slowdown or a single disruption in their business model, they're going to blow up even though they're making great profits. Why? Because they've committed so much of the income to debt that any possible slowdown is going to blow them up. He's not concerned in any way, shape, or form about the profitability of the garbage pickup business. Just like the beer distribution business. We finance a lot of beer distributors. Once again, a great business if you can get into it. People like beer. Show of hands, who likes beer? See? We all like beer, right? And it's a great business. But once again, his point to me, which I want to share with you, is they've piled so much debt on top of these organizations buying and selling amongst themselves that there's no room for error. If there's any kind of disruption, it's not that they're going to be unprofitable. It's that because they have so much debt piled upon these incredibly profitable businesses, they're going to blow them up. So it's not just about profitability. It's about how much leverage has been applied to those individual businesses. Now, I want to look at a financing point that we probably don't talk about very often. I think that you need to really make financial engineering decisions based on relative prices. Once again, we talk about relative prices in economics more than we talk about absolute prices, because relative prices are more important than absolute prices. And I think the ultra-low interest rates we're currently seeing, which are not sustainable, have had a differential impact in the land market. And I think there's a real opportunity for disciplined farm managers and farm operators to do something different. It's about the bushels, not the acres. That's a slogan that I use with a lot of farmers. Land prices have responded, and correctly so, to higher crop prices and low interest rates. It would be foolish and unreasonable to not to think that land prices are going to run up based on higher crop prices and lowest interest rates. But I think at the same time, land improvements have not seen the same distorting factor. If you go back and look at what it costs to tile, level, irrigate, or soil enhance an acre today versus 2005 and 2006, the actual cost per acre is not substantially different than what it was back in that period. Why? Because there's more of a supply for those inputs. There's more competitiveness. The land market's constrained to the number of acres that existed previously. But the amount of irrigation, the amount of tiling, the amount of leveling, the amount of soil enhancement we can do is much more responsive in terms of the supply side. So it simply can't act as a monopoly and price up with the higher crop prices and the lower interest rates. There's more people out there who say, I can buy a leveling machine, I can buy a tiling machine, I can put some irrigation in for you. They're going to respond to the demand, but the price has not seen the same level of inflation because there's not the same constriction on the supply side. So the question I have to farmers is, how do I buy the cheapest bushels? Because you think your wealth comes from owning land. And the answer is, sure it does. But I know your income comes from selling corn. Your current income is not about the land. Your income is always about selling the output. And your net profits are about the difference between the revenues and the costs. So the question I have to you is, how do you buy the cheapest marginal bushel of production? Do you do it through a land market deal, or do you do it through a land improvement deal? So let's just use some really base numbers. If I could buy an acre of ground for $8,000, and I believe the actual proven history, the APH, is 180 bushels. Okay, how much of that actually goes back to the ground? 25%. We talked about this earlier. Yeah, I'm buying 180 bushel ground, but 180 bushels is not what goes back to me as the landlord. 25 bushels goes back to me as the landlord. Now, another 20% might come to me as the manager, but I might push it off to somebody else. So I get 25% of the 180 bushels. So I'm paying $8,000 to buy 45 bushels per year of production. I'm paying $178 per bushel. This is into infinity if you want to use these numbers. This is like a net present value calculation. Is that a good deal? I don't know. You know, if I don't value money, if I think these numbers are right, maybe I'm going to jump on that deal. But what about irrigation? If I could irrigate an acre of corn for $2,000, and that's going to add a 25-bushel yield bump on an ongoing basis, I'm buying $80 a bushel. Now, there's a lot of nuance in here. You can talk about, you know, the input cost for the water, availability, this, that. This is simply an example to illustrate the point. The question I should ask myself, if I have $500,000 of surplus cash beyond my needs for working capital, I want to make an investment in my farm, am I better off chasing farm ground, or could I take that $500,000 and invest it in existing acres, whether it's tiling, irrigation, leveling, soil enhancement, clearing brush, whatever it is that's holding me back? Can I buy my bushels from myself at a cheaper rate? That's a different question. Now, why don't people want to approach the problem with this approach? Because it's a lot more complicated. We know it's pretty easy. 180 bushel farm ground, this price, this part of the yield, easy, done. Makes sense. Maybe I'm in an area where irrigating is not done very often and there's a lot of issues about getting good water. Okay, yeah, but that's really going to be a huge benefit to me because complexity and barriers mean money. Easy deals are overpriced. Tough deals where you got to do a lot of research, you got to try something different, you got to put a lot of sweat and trouble into them, those are usually ones that aren't overpriced. People don't see them. They're not obvious. I'll talk about Western Minnesota where our family homestead is. There's not much irrigation out there, even though there should be. Why? Because they haven't done it in the past. Water's not easy to get. It's not a slam dunk. But there's a lot of reasons why it could be done, but they won't do it. I guarantee you, it is a much better buy of productivity to irrigate those acres rather than to buy existing overpriced acres. But people want to do the land deals because it's straightforward. It's easy. You know, you heard the first speaker today talk about managing those pivots. A lot of people are living in the 1970s. To manage a pivot, you got to get out there every morning and turn a crank. Not anymore. They don't know that. They haven't looked into it. They haven't done the research. Whether it is irrigation, tiling, leveling, soil enhancement, whatever, you need to go every single year and ask the question, what's my cheapest marginal productivity gain? Because if you just live in the easy deal world of buying ground, you give yourself a false choice. And farmers need to be pushed to think differently. And that's where an association like this really has a lot of benefit, saying, have you thought about it differently? Are you just taking the easy way out? So the right decision depends on the changing price and the technology. What was a good decision 5 years ago is not a good decision today. Why? Different prices, different price ratios, different technology. So every single year, we have to refinancially solve this question. We can't use last year's assumptions. We have to use today's assumptions. And think about the opportunity we have today to do these improvements. You can get 10-year money from any bank in this country at 3.5% if you're a good credit. 10-year money at 3.5%. You're never going to get that opportunity in the future. These numbers are historically deflated for a lot of reasons. So you have an opportunity to buy money today from the market, which is mispricing it based on Federal Reserve policy, and take that money and put it into your farming operation for long-term productivity enhancements that will pay themselves for decades. And people are not looking at it that way. They want to go right back to buy more land. So, what are some of the takeaways? I agree. Agree with Steve very much. I think there's going to be incredibly high volatility. I think U.S. ethanol policy is both politically and via the energy market a high source of volatility and will continue to be so. Another one is monetary policy. Steve talked about the fiscal cliff. The price of money is not zero. Can we agree that zero is not the right price for money? We get used to crazy as people. But zero is not a good price for money. The Federal Reserve says we should lend people money for the next year or two at zero. Think about what you're doing. Think about if this is a fair deal. This is like a, let's say you're going to do a deal with Warren Buffett. Why Warren Buffett? Because Warren Buffett's always going to pay you back. I can't think of anybody who's probably got more cash on hand than Warren Buffett. And you say to Warren, Warren, I got $1 million. I just don't need it today. What would you give it to borrow, you know, lend it to me for? You know, I'll take it from you for next year at 50 basis points. He won't give you 50 basis points. Let's say he gives you 25 basis points. He's going to borrow $1 million in a year back from now, give you back your $1 million plus $2,500. Ooh, wow. Okay, so we're discounting the risk of loss of money because Warren Buffett's going to have $1 million from a year from now. But what have you given up in that 1 year? We have inflation. Even 2% inflation means that you've lost purchasing power over 2 years. But more importantly, you've given up the opportunity for finding good investments. What if over the next year, something suddenly becomes available? One of your neighbors has an issue, health issue. They really like you. They offer to sell you ground at a reasonable market rate that is reasonable. And you say, oh, this is a great deal, but I don't have my money because I gave it to Warren Buffett for a year. You have illiquidity. You got inflation and you got illiquidity, and you're telling me that zero is a reasonable price for those conditions? We know that zero is not right. So, but we're sitting here at zero and saying, yeah, this makes sense. Why? Because we've been here for 5 years, right? We get used to crazy. This will not last. And when it changes, people will be shocked about it. So what are the land market consequences? Talked about this. We will see a response globally. If 85% of the grain is grown outside the United States and has half the yield that we have, once we get them started, thanks to higher prices, they're going to be competing on marginal cost, not absolute cost. Just like the ethanol plants. Once somebody brings production into production, ground into production, or bumps it up, they're not going to compete on you on the cost of getting in. They're going to compete with you on the cost of staying in. And those are two very, very different numbers. And we got to be ready for them because we shouldn't be surprised that we start a sleeping giant overseas. What about the last point? It's about the bushels, not the acres. We need and owe it to farmers to say to them, why just land? Why not productivity enhancements at these prices and these borrowing costs? It's a much better buy, dollar for dollar, bushel for bushel, than just buying more ground from your neighbor at an inflated price. Well, with that, I'm going to stop.